From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, stay out of Ukraine, the warning from the White House to Moscow following a surge of unrest across the crisis-hit country's eastern region.
We're concerned about several escalatory moves in Ukraine over the weekend, and we see those as a result of increased Russian pressure on Ukraine.
Also today, the world's largest exercise in democracy gets underway in India. We report on the anti-deportation protest encampment outside the White House, and track star Oscar Pistorius gives an emotional testimony in day 17 of his murder trial.
I have terrible nightmares about things that happen at night where I wake up and I can smell blood, and I wake up to being terrified.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Pro-Russian protesters have seized the regional government building in Donetsk, Ukraine, saying they've formed a People's Republic. Ukrainian officials are accusing Russia of playing a role in the recent unrest, saying Moscow wants to destabilize the situation in the east of the country and annex it, copying what happened earlier in Crimea. Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
Ukrainian police said pro-Russian protesters who seized state security headquarters in Lugansk have seized weapons. Highway police have reportedly closed down entrances into the city. On Sunday, protesters seized official buildings in three cities, including the regional administrative building in Donetsk. They demanded a referendum on whether to join Russia. At an emergency cabinet meeting, Ukraine's interim prime minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk blamed Russia for the unrest, saying that Moscow plans to destabilize the situation, bring troops in, and seize parts of eastern Ukraine.
In response to the situation in Donetsk, the White House is once again urging Russia to pull its troops away from the Ukrainian border. The U.S. is warning that further sanctions on Russia could come unless a diplomatic solution to the crisis is found. White House spokesman Jay Carney.
If Russia moves into eastern Ukraine, either overtly or covertly, this would be a very serious escalation. We call on President Putin and his government to cease all efforts to destabilize Ukraine.
South African Paralympic athlete Oscar Pistorius has broken down in court and apologized to the family of Reeva Steenkamp for shooting and killing their daughter. Pistorius took the stand for the first time in the murder trial against him, telling the court he's been unable to sleep and has been taking medication. Gary Alfonso reports.
Reeva Steenkamp's mother sat motionless and without expression in the court gallery as Oscar Pistorius cried while apologizing to them for what he had done. Once composed, a visibly exhausted Pistorius continued to tell the court he was unable and afraid to sleep for more than a year. He said he had previously been a victim of crime many times. The athlete has not yet given his account of the night he shot and killed his girlfriend.
The Joint Task Force hunting for the remains of missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 reports two more acoustic signals or pings have been picked up by an Australian Navy ship within the main search area. It's said to be a highly promising lead. Australia correspondent Arthur Stevens has more.
It was revealed on Sunday that two acoustic signals have been picked up by a Chinese ship using hydrophones, while Australia's Ocean Shield vessel had detected a signal in a different part of the Indian Ocean search zone. Retired Air Chief Marshal Angus Houston, who's in charge of coordinating the search from Perth, says the Ocean Shield on Monday picked up signals on two separate occasions in the northern part of the search zone.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Iran is holding a new round of talks with six world powers in Vienna about its controversial nuclear program. It's hoped Iranian officials and international negotiators will come closer to settling differences over Iran's nuclear ambitions, which Iran insists are peaceful. Europe correspondent Sandra Gatman reports.
An Iranian delegation led by Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif is in the Austrian capital this week to meet with EU Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton, negotiating on behalf of the U.S., France, Germany, Russia, China, and Britain. The two sides are going over technical reports about Iran's nuclear program before drafting an agreement due to be signed in June. It would see a lifting of economic sanctions against Iran that were already partially loosened during talks last November. Iranian state media media claims Tehran is hopeful drafting can begin soon, though U.S. officials insist the process won't begin before May.
And the U.S. State Department says Israeli and Palestinian negotiators continue to hold serious talks about forging a peace deal. The talks were supposed to craft some sort of an agreement by the end of the month, but recent signals indicate the process is all but dead despite American support. Priscilla Huff has more from Washington.
The Obama administration continues to try to put a positive spin on meetings between Israeli and Palestinian negotiators. According to a statement from the U.S. State Department, the most recent meeting between the two sides was serious and constructive, and in another sign of the U.S. role as mediator, reportedly asked that the United States convene another meeting to continue the effort. While Palestinian experts say their people are frustrated and tired, the Israeli position may have been expressed bluntly by Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, who said his nation was not interested in Palestinian blackmail and would rather call elections than grant concessions.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
If Russia moves into eastern Ukraine, either overtly or covertly, this would be a very serious escalation. We call on President Putin and his government to cease all efforts to destabilize Ukraine.
Growing instability in eastern Ukraine is being stirred by Russia. The assessment from the White House Monday. Spokesman Jay Carney added that evidence suggested pro-Russian protesters in the region were being financed by Moscow. Once again, the Obama administration called on Russia to cease efforts to destabilize Ukraine and withdraw its vast troop buildup along the border. Russia maintains it's prepared to intervene in Ukraine's east to protect Russian speakers from what it calls far-right extremists. Washington has already hit Russia with sanctions over its annexation of Crimea, with the threat of additional punitive measures if Moscow escalates the crisis. For more on the story, I spoke to journalist Gulliver Cragg in one of the trouble spots in eastern Ukraine.
Well, across all of eastern Ukraine, the significance of what's happened this weekend is that the pro-Russian protesters, if you want to call them that, or anti-Kiev protesters, seem to have got a lot more virulent and a lot more prepared to use violence. Donetsk is the city where their demands have been the strongest and where they've actually apparently managed to take over the regional administration building and retain control there. But there were also violent incidents in Lugansk and here in Kharkiv, where also the protesters, well, in Kharkiv they took over the regional administration building. In Lugansk it was the secret services offices that they took over, the former KGB. In Kharkiv, though, they've more or less been forced to leave the regional administration headquarters, but they are gathered, and there are several thousand of them now in front of it, still protesting, so it's very much an ongoing situation.
I'm sure you've spoken to some of these pro-Russian protesters. When you ask them what do they want to achieve, what do they tell you?
That's an interesting question, because they generally say they want a referendum, but then when you ask them what the question in the referendum should be, you get a wide variety of different views. Some of them say they clearly want to join Russia. Others say that they want autonomy or even independence for their region or for these three eastern regions put together. Some say that they would be happy to stay within a united Ukraine if certain conditions are met in terms of respect for the Russian language and other concerns that they have. There's quite a lot of confusion, and there's a wide variety of different people as well, because there do seem to be people who are very genuinely concerned about the nature of the new government in Kiev and the way that it came to power, and who are local people. And there also seem to be people who've come from elsewhere. We've had incidences, for example, where protesters thought that they were protesting outside the town hall here in Kharkiv, and in fact it was a theater. So there definitely is evidence that at least some of the protesters are so-called tourists who've come over from Russia.
Ukrainian officials are describing what's happening in eastern Ukraine at the moment as Russia's attempts to dismember Ukraine, to destabilize Ukraine. They talk about a second wave, that first wave obviously being Crimea. But how does the situation in Crimea differ from the area of the country that you're now in?
Well, first of all, certainly the similarities are quite obvious in terms of getting protesters to take over administrative buildings. The pattern is similar to what happened in Crimea. And actually, Mikhail Saakashvili, the former Georgian president, has noted that it's very similar to the pattern of what happened in Georgia in 2008 before Russia invaded Georgia. But the very big difference between Crimea and eastern Ukraine is that a large proportion, and I think a majority, of the population of Crimea consider themselves to be Russians and have always considered themselves to be Russians. And there was, although it was small, there was a separatist movement in Crimea already. In eastern Ukraine, most people here don't consider themselves to be Russians. They consider themselves to be Russian-speaking Ukrainians. And until all this trouble started, there was no separatist movement here at all. People here were more or less happy to be Russian-speaking Ukrainians living in an independent Ukraine. There were some concerns about the status of the Russian language, but they really weren't something that was about to blow up into some kind of major separatist movement.
Journalist Gulliver Cragg in Kharkiv, eastern Ukraine. This is FSN Reports. A group of children and parents of immigrants detained and deported by the Obama administration have set up a protest encampment outside the White House. The demonstration comes as newly released federal data reveals the vast majority of those deported committed only minor infractions or had no criminal record at all. Our Washington correspondent Alice Olstein has the story.
Arizona resident Jose Valdez is one of a small group of demonstrators now on day three of an indefinite vigil outside the White House. Addressing a crowd of supporters, he explained that he's protesting for the release of his son Jaime, who was brought to the U.S. at age 14.
Estoy aquí.
I'm here in front of the White House because I have a son who was unfairly stopped and detained in Phoenix, Arizona, for a small traffic infraction.
Valdez's son, now 31 years old, was deported to Mexico in February. He publicly recrossed the border in March and is currently being held in detention while he petitions for humanitarian parole. His older brother, Luis Felipe, was deported last year and was killed in Mexico while being robbed.
So we'll hold this encampment until we're heard and until the deportations are stopped and we're allowed to pursue our dreams, the dreams we've been pursuing since we left our countries of birth.
Though President Obama has repeatedly claimed his administration focuses immigration enforcement on serious criminals, federal data obtained through the Freedom of Information Act and published by the New York Times Monday says otherwise. Internal records show that since President Obama took office in 2009, two-thirds of the nearly 2 million deportations involved people who committed only minor infractions, including traffic violations, or had no criminal record at all. The Obama administration has also doubled the number of so-called expedited removals, in which undocumented people have mere minutes with a lawyer. Many activists organizing the White House protest, including 23-year-old Reyna Montoya, said they blame both President Obama and lawmakers, including the Congressional Hispanic Caucus, for not doing enough to stem the tide of deportations.
They have said that they support immigration reform and they support the immigrant families, but when we go to their offices with cases, they close the door on us and they don't really support. So it's like, how can you be so hypocritical? Because I'm sorry, but that's being hypocritical, saying that you support immigrant families and that they deserve citizenship, but they don't deserve to be in this country. You cannot create a letter of support saying that these families deserve to be together. So it's definitely a big disconnect.
On Monday, another group of undocumented activists staged sit-ins at the offices of Congressional Hispanic Caucus members Loretta Sanchez and Javier Becerra to demand they publicly ask the president to suspend deportations. Sanchez, a California Democrat, had the protesters arrested by the Capitol Police. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Olympic track star Oscar Pistorius gave evidence for the first time Monday as his murder trial entered a fifth week in South Africa. The athlete, known as the Blade Runner, is accused of killing his girlfriend Reva Steenkamp last year. In an emotional delivery, Pistorius apologised to Steenkamp's family before talking about his own experiences of being a victim of crime and his struggle to overcome disability.
I can't imagine the pain and the sorrow and the emptiness that I've caused you and your family. I was simply trying to protect Reva I can promise that when she went to bed that night, she felt loved. I've tried to put my words on paper many, many times to write to you, but no words would ever suffice.
Our correspondent covering the case is Gary Alfonso, and he joined me earlier from South Africa.
Very emotional when it started out. Oscar Pistorius asking the court special permission up front to apologize to the parents of Reeva Steenkamp. And he said in a very emotional tone, breaking down, crying, that he apologized. He was sorry for what he had done. And he was there was not a morning that he didn't wake up and didn't think of them. And he had them in his prayers. Reeva Steenkamp's mother sitting in court, completely motionless and without any sign of any emotion on her face, and sat motionless while he read out or apologized to them. And then when he composed himself, Oscar Pistorius got down to also telling the court that his condition was deteriorated over the past year, and he was afraid to sleep. He was on medication, and he was waking up terrified in the middle of the night, calling his sister to come over and join him. And also that he had been a victim of crime in South Africa many times. His house had been burgled. He had been followed home by strangers, and also shot at on the highway. So very much trying to paint a picture of somebody who doesn't fit the role of what the prosecution has been trying to do over the past 3 to 4 weeks in the court, and that is paint a picture of a gun-obsessed person who likes to fire firearms. So very emotional and very dramatic, and a lot of impact with Oscar Pistorius taking the stand but not getting to the events of that night in which Reeva Steenkamp died yet.
So we've been hearing about a man who has been a victim of crime in the past, as you said. Is this perception of his paranoia as a consequence of these past experiences, is there a sense that that's working for the defence?
Well, I think the fact that it's been raised so early in Oscar Pistorius's own testimony basically indicates that it must have been discussed up front, that that is one of the perceptions that they should try and change as this goes forward, that he's much more of a calculated and careful person, but still a victim of crime, and also a person that has had to live or learn to live without limbs all his life, and has always been kind of like the underdog, and has always had to battle and fight for recognition and his place in the sun. So at the end of the day, even though very initial historical testimony from Oscar Pistorius in court, very telling that it goes after the perceptions of him and also the emotional apology to the parents, saying upfront that Reeva Steenkamp felt loved on that evening, the night before she was shot and killed, and basically trying to reach out to them to tell them that he loved her very much and that he had tried to protect her. So very much trying to get away from that obsessive kind of picture or perception that the prosecution has been going after in very deliberately over the past 3 to 4 weeks.
Our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso. Now, the largest exercise in democracy anywhere in the world got underway today. India's 814 million registered voters are now participating in the country's general election. There are so many voters, the polls will stay open until May 12th just to accommodate everyone. 543 seats are up for grabs in the lower house of the country's parliament, and the ruling Congress Party is under enormous pressure in the polls from the Hindu nationalist BJP, led by Narendra Modi. Mr. Modi is the chief minister of the Gujarat state, and though he's dogged by accusations of fomenting anti-Muslim violence in 2002, he's been consistently ahead of Rahul Gandhi, his Congress Party rival in the polls. FSN's Simon Marks reports that the outcome of the election will not necessarily improve India's strained relationship with the USA.
His name is Narendra Modi, and for the past decade in Indian politics, he's been the man to watch. The chief minister of Gujarat state, he leads the country's Hindu nationalist BJP, a party that has been in opposition to India's government, but he hopes this election campaign will change all that.
So, this will start to come.
Bhajpa ko vote de,
Ab ki baar Modi Sarkar.
In BJP campaign advertisements, Modi tells the country's 814 million eligible voters that India will be safe in his hands. He has a compelling story to tell. In Gujarat, a northwestern coastal state with a population of more than 60 million, he's presided over an economic transformation. He's reduced poverty rates, brought in foreign investment, cut levels of malnutrition, and reduced the amount of water it takes for Gujarat farms to yield produce, a key issue on the campaign trail, given that more than half India's voters live in rural communities. Mr. Modi portrays himself as a modern Democrat who delivers in the interests of all voters.
By now, it is proved beyond doubt that people's own government in a democracy is the best possible system. It may have its limitations, but nothing better has evolved.
But it's not all plain sailing for Mr. Modi. He cannot escape questions about the role he played in shocking anti-Muslim violence that convulsed Gujarat in 2002. At least 1,000 people were killed, and Mr. Modi has been accused of fanning the flames. The BJP insists numerous inquiries, including probes by India's independent Supreme Court, have not led to any charges being brought against Mr. Modi. But many observers say, as Prime Minister, he would be a risk for India, a country with complex ethnic politics. His principal opponent in the election, Rahul Gandhi of the ruling Congress Party, is the son of assassinated Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi. In an appearance on India's Times Now television, he was asked why he blames Mr. Modi for the 2002 violence, but denies the culpability of the then ruling Congress Party for anti-Sikh violence back in 1984.
The difference between the 84 riots and the riots in Gujarat was that in 1984, the government was trying to stop the riots. I remember, I was a child then, I remember that the government was doing everything it could to stop the riots. In Gujarat, the opposite was the case. The government in Gujarat was actually abetting and pushing the riots further.
Mr. Gandhi has been faulted for diffidence on the campaign trail. He often appears as a reluctant heir apparent to his late father. And his mother, the Italian-born Sonia Gandhi, remains a powerful figure behind the scenes for the Congress Party, further muddying the waters of what exactly a government led by her son would look like. There are dozens of other parties contesting the elections, including one, the AAP, that has performed strongly in local elections with an anti-corruption message. But the polls suggest Mr. Modi and the BJP are on course to dominate the next government. Analyst Bob McMahon of the Council on Foreign Relations says Indian voters are in the mood for change.
The BJP is talked of as this party of trade and a party that can kind of get the trains moving, so to speak. We'll see how legitimate that reputation is. But there is this sense that India wants to get moving and they want to have somebody who runs the country like a CEO. And so they're hoping that will be the case.
A Modi victory does not necessarily mean that the fractured relationship between India and the United States might soon be mended. For the past 6 months, the two countries have been at loggerheads after an Indian diplomat in New York was strip-searched, then arrested and charged with committing visa fraud. Eventually, she left the United States, but her treatment at the hands of American law enforcement led to widespread protests in India. And now the country may be on the verge of picking a prime minister with a record tarnished by his alleged involvement in communal violence. Analyst Jim Lindsay of the Council on Foreign Relations says if Narendra Modi forms the next Indian government, things could remain complicated between Washington and Delhi.
He has been accused of, at a minimum, having turned a blind eye to anti-Muslim riots in Gujarat back in 2002. And that's led to a real sort of chill on the part of the United States in dealing with Mr. Modi.
The outcome of the election won't be known for weeks. Polls stay open for over a month to give everyone a chance to participate. So for now, the world can watch an astonishingly large exercise in democracy and wonder about where India is heading. This is Simon Marks reporting.
This is FSN Reports. This week, we're remembering the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, when an estimated 800,000 people were killed in the course of 100 days. The victims were mainly ethnic Tutsis, along with some moderate Hutus. As the crisis began to unfold, foreigners were provided with a 72-hour window to leave the country. Only one American stayed. He's been speaking to our Washington correspondent, Daniel Renches.
Our thoughts were about ourselves.
This is Carl Wilkins, talking to an audience at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum.
We were not thinking about, if this thing blows, what are we going to do for the Rwandan people?
This is Carl Wilkins 20 years ago.
Electricity went off yesterday and it's so... that seems too close.
He was a Christian missionary living in Kigali with his wife, three small children, a young Tutsi woman who worked at his home, and a male night security guard.
And the embassy had said no Rwandans in the vehicles. Many from Europe were flying out, but the Americans, Canadians were driving out. No Rwandans. And so how are we going to leave these people, knowing that pretty much guaranteed if we left them, they would be killed?
Carl's wife, Teresa, and their three children left with the convoys. Carl stayed to protect the two Tutsis who worked there. He then ventured through armed checkpoints, the sound of gunfire, and the scenes of massacre to the Gisimba orphanage.
It was just an overwhelming sense of hopelessness. And yet, you would have these little victories, so to speak. You'd get a truckload of water to the orphanage, and the kids would all come there with a little metal cup. And, you know, there was this sense of success. But so it was an interesting mixture, I guess you could say, of overwhelming horrors and yet feeling like, okay, for this day, this spot, we are able to make a difference.
On one occasion, the 400 or so in the orphanage were surrounded by more than 50 armed militiamen who said they would kill those inside if they stayed. Carl went to the office of a colonel he knew for help when he saw the Prime Minister, Jean Kambanda.
Like, wait, how do you ask somebody who's in charge of the genocide to stop a massacre? And so some very illogical, bizarre events often came together.
Kambanda assured Wilkins that the orphanage would be protected. Kambanda later pled guilty to committing genocide at the International Criminal Court. Wilkins went on to save other orphans, risking his life on many occasions to do so.
In terms of a culture of respect and value of foreigners, on many counts, that worked to my advantage. On a few counts, it didn't, in that I stood out. They threatened to kidnap me at different times. Rumors were going around, and you know, so that in, you know, having a certain amount of privilege had its downside as well.
Carl Wilkins and his wife Teresa spent a year and a half in Rwanda after the genocide to assist with the rebuilding process.
20 years on, some will say this is an old news story.
No, Rwanda, you know, I've been back there 9 times in the last 5 years, and every time I go back, there's more and more stories. Not only stories about 1994, horrible stories, but also courageous stories. Stories now of forgiveness that so many in Rwanda, I mean, it's not perfect, tons of challenges still, but so many in Rwanda have decided they will not be defined by what was taken from them. They're defined by what they do with what remains.
Carl Wilkins with FSN's Daniel Renches. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to email us, you can, reports@featurestory.com. And you can always follow us on Twitter. We're there, @featurestory. Coming up on Tuesday, we look at the Department of Agriculture's controversial decision to approve the import of processed chicken from China. That's Tuesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Kate Fisher and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.